Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Welcome to NPR News Presents. I'm Stephen John. This hour, you'll hear the second program in this fall's Talking Volumes series. Carl Hiaasen is a regular columnist for the Miami Herald, as well as the writer of several satirical novels. His latest is called Razor Girl, and it takes place in his native Florida, a state he loves to lampoon. Last week, he joined Talking Volumes host Carrie Miller on the stage of the Fitzgerald Theater.
What do you think is so satisfying about that squirmy feeling even while we're laughing? Because I think that's part of what satire is. And I want to flesh that out a little more, but what is the deal with that?
Well, first of all, I think this is a year that everyone is desperate to laugh. It does keep your sanity. And for those of us who are perpetually pissed off, there is a therapy to reading it, and there's a therapy to writing it. Believe me, I would do it whether it was getting published or not. It's sort of a socially acceptable outlet for some of my anger. But I think if you talk to a lot of writers who write humor, satire, at the root of all of it is some anger and indignation, a sense of outrage about injustice. I mean, you can either go two ways. You can get on a soapbox and scream and yell about it, or you can use the weapon of humor, which in the newspaper column as well as in the novels, it's far more effective. And you talk about making them squirm. You can write about these, you can write about politicians, for example, all you want to, ranting about it. But once you start making fun of them and it's hitting close to home, you really start ruining their day, which is the whole point. I mean,
they don't like to be made fun of, right?
No, they do not like.
Isn't that funny, though, that most politicians would rather have you rant about their policy than make them look like fools? Why?
I think they know how to puff up and fight back to the sort of soapbox rant, but they don't have. They're not either clever enough or not. In some cases, they don't have a sense of humor anyway. We have a governor now in Florida who banned the use of the phrase climate change or global warming among all staff and agencies in a state where part of Miami Beach is underwater on high tide now, and he still won't let anyone say what's happening. So. And he has really no sense of humor. And I actually don't think he gets some of the columns I write. I really think they just go flying over his head.
Yeah, when he banned that phrase, that was within state departments, wasn't it? That people were not allowed to actually use that phrase.
The Department of Environmental Regulation could not use the phrase climate change. Anyway, I could go on about that guy.
Don't let me stop you.
No. Yeah, well,
we've got all night.
No, we're... we get... Well, okay, let me say something. Let me say something about this. You've all been following the Zika scare, and it's real. It's a real disease, and it's a real serious thing. But in Florida, it's all about the tourism. You have to understand something. This is about presenting a picture of Florida where, please come, it's safe, nothing to worry about, all is fine. And so the first press conference, there's a neighborhood called Wynwood in Miami, and my granddaughter goes to school there, so I know it. And that was where the first outbreak was, which means that was the only place where people were showing symptoms. People were getting bit all over the place. So Rick Scott goes down, and he's going to hold a reassuring press conference after news of this has been leaking out for a long time. And there's a graphic behind him, and it's a map. It's a road map of Wynwood, and there's a square area, and he said that's where it's contained. There's like 54th Street. And it's like the mosquitoes can read. They're not going to go, because they're going to stop. They're going to come to the stoplight and say, oh, no, we can't go past there. And it was the most insulting thing in the world. And he's very soberly, seriously saying, the rest of Miami is perfectly safe. These are freaking mosquitoes. They'll go wherever they want. They'll bite whoever they want. So that's just, that's what we're dealing with.
That's
Florida.
You're doing a, aren't you doing an event soon with Dave Barry? Didn't I hear you say that?
Yeah, Dave and I are doing a thing I think at the end, next week, I think in Miami, we have a thing together. And then we're doing another one for the First Amendment Foundation in Florida in October, where we're just going to get up and be silly. He's on tour with his new book.
Which is called... He talks about the punchline state of Florida, and he says, if states were characters on Seinfeld, Florida would be Kramer. Every time it appears, the audience automatically laughs.
That's right.
Knowing it's going to do some idiot thing.
That's true.
You'll have a lot to talk about.
Yeah, and we've been friends for a long time, and so it's an easy gig with Dave. We just tell stories. In fact, his book is nonfiction, but he mentions at least one of the true news stories that appear in my novel in a fictionalized version, which I just poached from the headlines. He recites the same. We didn't even know that was happening until we each wrote our books.
You know what I'm curious about is whether... I was thinking about how the late Molly Ivins used to talk about what sat... She was... Wonderful.
Yes, it was terrific.
And she would talk about how satire is how the powerless put one over on the powerful. Do you agree with that? You looked a little not so sure.
Well, I think it's an effort to do that. I don't know that it always works, but I think the whole point of satire and the reason that those of us who do it love our readers so much is because they're laughing for the right reasons. They get it. You get the joke. I mean, it's not just writing a scene that's sort of cinematically funny or slapstick, but the lines that you're delivering, when you're writing them, you're delivering them for a certain audience who's thinking a certain way and who maybe doesn't have any way else to express it or anywhere else to laugh about it. And I think that's the loyalty you sort of feel to people who do, at this point, and let's face it, in this year, where you feel like, where do you turn? What's happening to the country? What's happening to the world? I mean, we feel that every day in Florida, but the rest of the country needs to laugh too. But I think it's also a very selfish thing.
Absolutely.
Because, I mean, I think if any writer sits there and tells you that they're not writing for themselves, first and foremost, they're probably lying. I mean, if you're not writing as well as you can to put something on paper that pleases you or that you think is good, I mean, then you're not doing your job. I mean, it's got to come. If it's going to be good, it's got to come from somewhere inside of you. So that's what I meant by therapy. I mean, it really is part of the process of purging. I mean, I still do the newspaper column for the Herald, and that's fine once a week. But there's a lot left unsaid or unexpressed. And you can actually sometimes get closer to the marrow of true life with a novel and with humor than you can when you're working out of a notebook in a newspaper. I mean, you ask any newspaper reporter, and we talked about it today over at the Star Tribune, you write a story, and that's what you can get in. But there's a lot that you just can't get into that story. And the novel gives you that broad tapestry to go and do it. And I mean, I don't think you start out with the mission of anything other than entertaining people, but you have to entertain yourself while you're doing it.
You know, I'm appreciative that you said that about the way you can tell truth in fiction. It's something that I talked about with Elizabeth Alexander last week. Why is that you can tell a certain kind of truth in a certain way in fiction that may have a whole different impact than it would in journalism?
Well, I can give you an example. For instance, a few years ago I wrote a novel called Sick Puppy, and it was about this awful lobbyist. I invented what I thought was the world's worst lobbyist based on some of the lobbyists I knew and I had reported on over the years. But the thing is, when you're reporting a story, you know, all you can report is the lobbyist showed up at the county commission meeting and Commissioner so-and-so suddenly changed his vote. And the zoning change went through, and now the Walmart's going to be built, or whatever. that's all you, because that's all you know, and that's all that's in the public record, and they're not talking to you.
Right.
But you know what happened if you cover enough county commissions. You know exactly what happened. So in a novel, you can just put that in there. And just the whole, you know, the whole slime trail can be illuminated. Now, when that novel came out, I had a couple lobbyists. You know, I bumped into them somehow afterwards, and it was interesting because they loved the book because they thought it was about the other one. They thought it was about that guy. They said, "Boy, you nailed him good. You got him down." And I'm thinking, you know, I mean, the vanity is an incredible thing. They just didn't see themselves in it. But they would say to me, "That's exactly how it works." I mean, that's it. So my motto is, it's as bad as you think it is. That it's just as bad as you think it is.
So uplifting. You know, I kind of imagine you as an angry teenager. Were you?
Well, yeah, I mean, I don't know if
I want to know how you got to this.
I mean, I think my mom wanted to know. She went to her grave wondering how I got to this. I think it started before then, and then I before I was even a teen. I mean, I always wanted to write, but I think as a kid growing up where I did, which was out in the West, you know, right near the Everglades, and it was a very rural childhood, and it was, you know, there was, you just came home from school, you got on your bike, and you disappeared with your fishing rod, or, you know, and it was just one of those kinds of childhood. And then when you, even at that age, with the development and the population boom in Florida, the places that I was going fish, places my friends and I would hang out, were starting to disappear under concrete. And I remember being pissed off at a fairly young age about that. I mean, and I think that's not just a Florida experience. I think almost everybody in this room has some special place from their childhood that you wished was still around to show your kids or your grandkids, but it's gone now. And so, and the book's connected at that level way beyond Florida. But I think it started with myself at a young age. In high school, I did do sort of an underground newsletter called More Trash. And it was...
More Trash.
More Trash. And okay. I typed it myself. We had a mimeograph machine. Y'all remember what that was? And so we'd hand crank it out, and then people hand it out in the hallways. And it was, you know, it poked fun at the administration of the school, even the football team, which was sacrilegious. But it was just me being a smartass. And it was the first time I'd ever gotten any feedback from people would stop me in the halls and say, "When's the next one coming out?" That was funny as hell. And I thought, you know, people were reacting in a way that, again, I was writing it kind of as an inside joke for kids like me that weren't part of the cliques and they weren't part of sort of the jock fraternity or anything. We certainly weren't beloved by the administration. And I thought, well, maybe I'm on to something. But it was nice because to have someone stop and say, I laughed my ass off at your newsletter. And, you know, that, I think, you know, set me on this dark path. I think that's what...
What did the principal think of More Trash?
I don't think he liked it very much.
And you didn't care.
I couldn't give a rat's ass.
And you still don't.
I still don't. No. Look, they all had their job to do, but I'm about to tell a story. This is awful. This is really sophisticated humor, high school humor. Like my senior year, the last one I'm going to do of these, and I'm cranking it out. So I cleverly underlined... underlined seven letters in this long, very long newsletter that was handed out, thinking nobody would get it except my friends. The letters, the first letter was F. And I was mortified. I hadn't got my diploma yet. Everybody got it. And it was a mimeograph sheet with just these little marks on it. It was just for some of my friends, you know, the guys or my buddies. And everyone's going, "Hey, I saw what you did in the news." I'm going, "Holy crap, I'm not going to get my diploma after all. My dad's going to kill me." But that was.
Maybe you're still doing that.
Yeah.
What if I page through here?
Yeah, don't, please.
There
no,
wouldn't
no,
be
I,
some.
I've advanced. I hope past then. I haven't even told that story to my the high school junior in my house, and I now he's probably going to find out.
Yeah, I'm sure he listens to Minnesota Public Radio.
Yeah.
Doesn't everybody?
Yes, but
wherever they are. Who was funny in your family? Was it a sibling? Which of your parents?
Well,
where'd this come from?
Well, my dad, that side of the family was Norwegian, so that answers the part of the question.
That would be a no. It wasn't
not
him.
Not a lot of yucks. But I will say, even though my dad was a more serious guy, he's also the one that gave me, told me to read Catch 22 and said, you got to read this.
Really?
This is a funny book. He's also the one that would sit there and say, you know, he loved to watch comedy acts, you know, Mike Nichols and Elaine May back in those days. And he was the first one to bring home Bill Cosby albums, which in South Florida, trust me, And when I was growing up, you know, that's a big deal. And but I mean, so he had a sense of humor, but his you know, he was just a grim Norwegian. And my mom was
we know the type.
We're on hallowed ground here.
We
for
are.
This. And my mom was half Irish and half German, so I think it was that quarter Irish that probably she had a good open sense. I mean, the German, no laughs there at all. I'm sorry, but you know what I'm talking about. There was just not much. I think probably my mom. And although I have to say that when I started doing these novels years ago, and she was raised in this pretty strict Irish Catholic household in Chicago, and you know, my aunt was a nun and my uncle was a priest.
Wow.
And here I am writing some of what I write, and I was always nervous about maybe you always are with your mom. I was always nervous about the language, and I just thought, oh my God, she's gonna have a, I don't know how much she actually read. She always said she read the books, but I think she got like page three and said, well, okay, that's that. Oh boy, he's done it again. But I know she read. She was faithfully read everything I wrote in the newspaper. You know, I mean, wow. I think that was probably what made her the most proud, if I had to guess.
When did you know you were funny?
That's a good question. Going back to maybe high school, and I, you know, having people like say they liked that silly newsletter, and then I would write little things and show my friends, and they would laugh. But I didn't think about, you know, I mean, when you get into the newspaper business, I was covering, you know, I was on the city desk and doing all this stuff, and it wasn't your job to be funny then.
Right.
But I knew that I wanted to write more than that, and I wanted to write satirical things, and I wanted to write about things I cared about, and I cared about Florida and what was happening to Florida, and I had targets in mind even at a young age that I really want to be public enemy one, number one, to the Chamber of Commerce. That was my one one goal. I got to say, one of my proudest moments was at some point, after some column I wrote in the Miami Herald, one of the Miami City Commissioners, he had a resolution that he put out just condemning me on general principle for something I had
done. Is that real?
And I called,
is that true?
That is true. And I called my editor in New York. At the time, I was with Putnam's, and I said, is there any way we can get this on the book jacket? I thought that... that was the best blurb, you know, we could possibly get, is to get this guy. But no, so I was always a little bit of a bomb thrower, I guess, like that.
Yeah, I mean, those are just gifts to someone like you.
Yeah.
Do they know that?
No,
this,
he didn't.
This
he wasn't
commissioner?
Real,
I mean,
no. It was better than you could imagine. It was so great. The more they talk about it, it's like the thing, Willie, with the whole book banning thing. One time, I got a letter from a school librarian in Waco, Texas, okay? And this was one of the children's books. I think it was either Hoot or Flush. And she come across the word, I believe it was butt, referring to somebody's butt, right? And, I mean, it was very mild. There was nothing in the book. But she said, we're taking your book off the shelves. And she said, I took your book and I took it into the cafeteria and I showed it to some of our cafeteria workers and they agreed that it was obscene. I was turning cartwheels. I was so happy. And I wrote a letter back that was probably, I don't think my publisher appreciated, but it made me feel good. And saying I'm so glad you went to the literary authority of the cafeteria workers to ask what they thought of my books. But this is
the thing that the book banners never and next week is Banned Books Week.
Yeah.
That they never get. It just sells more books.
That's exactly right.
Which
you
is
ask
the
any
greatest
author,
thing.
The best thing that can happen to
I know.
You is that somebody in Waco, Texas says, they're taking his book out of the school system. Please, God, take my book out of the Waco school system. Thank you. Thank you, God.
How long has it been since you've been on the banned book list?
Oh, God, I don't know. And not all of them get banned. I try.
You Darn
know,
it all.
But I think going back to... I don't know. I mean, you know, they're a little sensitive with the kids' books, but if you read what, young, middle school grade books now and what they call the YA, young adult readers' books, I mean, it's some heavy stuff, a lot heavier stuff than I write about, and there really is.
Yeah, there's a lot more than butt in.
Absolutely, and the subject matter is you forget the language, the subject matter is pretty heavy. So, I mean, I think, it's so different from when I was a kid. And, you know, I mean, I love the Hardy Boys. I've read every Hardy Boys novel there. It was a big deal. But we didn't have the library selection. There weren't books about being in an abusive household or being all the things that, I mean, heavy stuff. We just didn't have that. So I think it's come a long, long way. And it was interesting, you know, after... after 9/11 and then after some of the, you know, recession, you know, the financial stuff, the hardback fiction market for adult books, grown-up books, took a hit. Everybody was more buying nonfiction if they were buying anything. Right. Well, the one segment of the market that hung tough and even prospered for all of it was books for kids. Because parents, even if they were strapped, might not be buying books for themselves, but they kept buying books for their children. It was the most interesting thing, and it's still one of the strongest segments of the book market. Yeah, I mean, it was heartwarming because they were still out there buying the books, and kids were actually reading, which is always gratifying. If you got kids, you know what I'm talking about.
I was thinking... a few years ago, Judy Blume was here, and we were talking. You know, she's been through the mill on the banned book stuff and heard from a lot of readers on that. And her theory about this is that, and I don't know if this applies to that interchange you had with the woman in Waco, but her theory is the people that are most uncomfortable with content, in sexual content or that kind of content, are the people that don't want to have that conversation with their kids.
Sure.
And she's like, they already know, or this is the way to get that discussion going, and you can't hide from it.
Right. I think there are in some places teachers like that too that think if we don't talk about it and they don't learn about it, they'll be 21 and they'll be all grown up before they ever, you know, they ever see it, somebody with a joint, or they ever, or anybody ever tries to kiss them, or anything like that. I mean, they think that world is going to protect them, and it's not going to. I will say that there are limits, though, because I've always one of the reasons I started writing the kids' book was because I didn't want. I mean, my stepson was about 11 when I started working on Hoot, and my nieces and nephews about the same age. And they weren't allowed to go anywhere near the grown-up novels that I was writing. But mainly it was the language. But it was also, there were adult situations that I didn't think, you know, I was a dad and I just didn't think it was good. And so I thought, well, if I write some books for kids, that I can, at least I can put something in their hands and say, here's what I do for a living. I felt if nobody else read those books but the kids in my family, that would be worth doing at least one of them. Because I have always, there was always been sort of a cutoff at like age 13 or 14 in our house about when they could, Dad, when can we get that one off the shelf, you know? But I'll tell you a funny story. I was at a book signing in Miami, and this was a book, the novel before this, it was called Bad Monkey. And Thanks. It was a pretty disturbing thing. But there was a monkey on the jacket, and it was a nasty looking monkey. And there are no good monkeys, by the way. I learned that on the Bad Monkey book tour, because everybody at the end, in every book signing line, there was one person that, like myself, once had a monkey as a pet, and the story never ended well. But anyway, this monkey was some kind of snarling monkey on the jacket. It was really a cool jacket, but I think at some level a kid might say, oh, it's a book about... Well, this was a book event for the grown-ups, but there were some kids there that had the kids' books wanting me to sign. And the kids' books usually have a one-word title, and most parents can figure out what's for the kids and what's not. I'm waiting in line, and there's a young girl, can't be more than 9 years old, and she's clutching to her chest a copy of Bad Monkey. And she's in line with her mother. So she comes up, and I said, hi, and she tells me her name. And she says, would you sign this for me? I said, you mean it's your mom's book, right? You're holding it for your mom? She goes, it's for me. And I said, you try to be diplomatic, but I said, and I just look at mom, maybe in a few years. And she goes, oh, no. We don't believe in any censorship in our house. And I said, okay. And then this little 9-year-old looks at me and she goes, oh, this is no big deal. She said, I've already read Lolita. Whoa. And all I can think of in my mind is, and I'm going to be reading about you in a headline someday. In my sick mind, I'm going, oh, my God. Oh, you've already read Lolita. Great, Lolita. Yeah, here's Tropic of Cancer. Go, have a good time. Jesus Christ. I mean, I don't mean to be old-fashioned about it, but, I mean, they got their whole life okay to read these books. Let's feed it to them when they're 9. That's great.
So.
And the only good thing is that she wasn't there with a 70-year-old date. That was...
So would you say this first scene in the novel, which I've asked you to read, is this PG? Is this PG-13? Is it R? What would you say?
Well, I'd say it's very tastefully done, so I'm going to say it's a PG, a mild R. Now, I haven't read it aloud, but can I say it is based on a real thing that happened down in the Florida, a real traffic accident. And this is, I took it and ran with it, but the actual particulars of the accident are right out of the newspaper. And it's one of the things that in Dave Barry's book, too. He talks about the actual accident. But, yeah, you want me to read it?
Yeah, if you would. You do say, this is a work of fiction, but truth is stranger than fiction in this category. This really happened?
This really happened. And I'll read you the section.
Okay.
If we got time, then I'll tell you how the newspaper handled this. I haven't read this aloud, so you might have to be patient with me. On the first day of February, sunny but cold as a frog's balls, I guess that's PG.
That's going on public radio right there.
A man named Lane Kuhlman stepped off a flight at Miami International, rented a mainstream Buick, and headed south to meet a man in Key West. He nearly made it. 27 miles from Kuhlman's destination, an old green Firebird bashed his car from behind. The impact failed to trigger the Buick's airbags, but Kuhlman heard the rear bumper dragging. He steered off the highway and dialed 911. In the mirror, he saw the Firebird, its grill crimped and steaming, pull onto the shoulder. Ahead stood a sign that read, Ramrod Key. Kuhlman went to check on the other driver, a woman in her mid-30s with red hair. Super-duper sorry, she said. What the hell happened? Just a nick, barely bleeding. She held her phone in one hand and a disposable razor in the other. Are you out of your mind? Said Kuhlman. The driver's jeans and panties were bunched around her knees. She'd been shaving herself when she smashed Kuhlman's rental car.
They're shocked.
I got a date, she explained. You couldn't take care of that at home? No way my husband would get so pissed. Unreal, said Kuhlman. The woman was wearing a maroon fleece jacket and rhinestone flip-flops. On her pale thigh was the razor mark. How about a little privacy? She said, I'm not quite done here. Kuhlman walked back to the Buick and called the man he was supposed to meet in Key West. I'll be a few minutes late. You're not going to believe what just happened, he said on the man's voicemail, leaving it at that. The cops arrived and wrote up the red-haired pube shaver for careless driving. Naturally, she had no collision insurance. That would be Avis's problem, not Lane Kuhlman's. A tow truck hauled away the Firebird, which needed a new front end, including a radiator. The woman approached Kuhlman and asked for a ride. Tell your date to come get you, he said. One of the police officers had pried the damaged bumper from the Buick, and Kuhlman was trying to fit it into the back seat. He doesn't have a car, said the woman who'd buttoned her jeans. She was attractive in a loose and scattered way. Kuhlman had a weakness for redheads. See, I work for an escort agency. We go to where the client's at, she said. Yes, I understand the concept. The woman's fleece was unzipped, and beneath it she wore a black sequined top. Her toes must be freezing in those flip-flops, Kuhlman thought. The temperature was 55 degrees with a biting north wind. Arctic conditions for the Florida Keys. My name's Mary, she said, spelled like Merry Christmas. My name's Bob, said Kuhlman, spelled like Bob. Does that mean you'll give me a lift? Why not, Kuhlman said, the worst mistake he would ever make. So that's... No, thanks.
That's columnist and novelist Carl Hiaasen reading from his new book, Razor Girl. More from Hiaasen in a moment. This is NPR News Presents. Now back to Carrie Miller and Carl Hiaasen at Talking Volumes. Hiaasen's latest book is called Razor Girl. We just heard an excerpt that sets up the novel that was based on a real incident in Hiaasen's home state of Florida.
Okay, tell the real story.
Well, the real story was a few years ago in the lower Florida Keys, a woman was driving south on A1A at about 55 miles an hour, and she ran into a car full of innocent tourists, if there is such a thing, and nobody was hurt, but when the cop arrived, the state trooper, in Florida, the cops have seen everything you can imagine. When the cop arrived and went back to see what the deal was with the car that struck the other car, that's what he saw. And he just said, are you kidding me? What are you doing? And she said, I got a date in Key West. Now, the real story, of course, what I changed. And then he said, you have a date in Key West. And he said, who's that in the car with you? And she goes, oh, that's my husband. I mean, her husband was riding with her on the date. Anyway, in the real story, it was an accident. In the novel, it's not an accident. It's a staged crash, which we also have in Florida. There's a whole industry of people who crash into other people on purpose to get car insurance, to get their insurance money. And so I kind of weaved those two together. But that's where it came from. It was a real event. My son, who was still working at the Herald at the time, my oldest boy, and he always emails me the sickest stuff, and he knows where it's going to end up.
Apple doesn't fall far from the tree.
He goes,
huh?
Hey, Dad, have you seen this one? And it's like, you know, he knows he's got me.
I have to say that Mary Mansfield is one of my the redhead in that scene is one of my favorite women that you've created. I don't know why. I spent a little bit of time thinking about what is so appealing. She's smart.
She's incredibly smart. She's clever. She's funny. And she was one of those characters that I just sort of, she sort of took over and I was just chasing her most
really?
Of the novel. Yeah, I fell for her too. I mean, you know, sometimes characters disappoint you and they let you down. You have high expectations. And other times you just got to hang on for the ride. And that's the way it was with her. I mean, the more she was on the page, there was more energy and more fun going on. So I kept her around.
Your women vary. Mary stands out to me for some of the attributes that you gave her. And now that I hear you say this about she kind of took over and you were chasing, I understand that.
You know, I always end up liking the women characters better, and I've written several novels where they were the main, in my view, the main character. I did a novel called Lucky You about a woman whose lottery ticket was stolen, and that Jolaine was the main character. I loved her, and even in Striptease, Erin was, I thought, a very strong character, and Nature Girl. So, and I mean, I've been, and they're always a step or two ahead of the guys, but that's life. You know, I mean, I don't think that's like extraordinary. That's been my experience my whole life.
Oh, let's talk about that.
No, let's not. No, that's not. That's not too bad.
No, let's really talk about that.
No.
Tell me more.
I've just been lucky to have known a lot of strong, smart women that figured things out way before I did, you know. And it's just been blessed in that way. And it's just been also my experience in observing relationships my male friends have had over time and where they ended up, some good, not so good, but you know, that's all I'm going to say about it. I think it's important to, I mean, part of the things you learn as a journalist is you do learn, if you do your new job, you learn to listen to how people really speak and listen to how they interact. Mm-hmm. And part of creating a good character on the page is having an authentic person. And no matter what they're doing, whether it's a criminal or whether it's the hero or a cop or whatever, a doctor. And I think that, and I've spent a lot of my life, you know, listening to women talk to me, and I picked up on some things, you know.
You know, it's interesting to hear you talk about the authenticity, because while I know you draw from real life in Florida, you create some pretty absurd scenarios.
Sure.
And yet the skill is channeling that authenticity in the midst of some of these really absurdist situations.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's sort of the trick of satire, and especially if you want people to keep turning the pages, you have to, it's a high wire act, balance the sort of the suspense and keeping the story moving, and then the humor, you want them laughing on every page. So you have to make the situation, while it may seem incredible to a lot of people in Florida, it's really more like documentary. They don't even blink at this stuff. But to a normal person in a normal place, there is absurdity to it. But there's almost nothing in this novel or any of the novels that I can't come back with and tell you a story like that or something similar.
Really, like some of that stuff in Bad Monkey.
Which,
really?
Tell me which.
Well, just the crazy scenarios.
For instance?
The monkey with the diaper and,
oh,
you know.
Oh, God, yeah. you've never had a monkey, but if you did have one, you would have some Pampers in the pantry because, but I'll give you an example.
Okay.
If you got a second from Bad Monkey, there's a character in there called the Dragon Queen, and she lives in the Bahamas, and she's a voodoo person.
Right.
That was very much drawn from a real individual. And I had known, and at least three of her boyfriends that I know of had expired under suspicious circumstances when they broke up with her, swear to God.
Wow.
And one of the guys who's a friend of mine was telling me about his uncle, that happened to her. And I was down in this remote island off Andros Island, and I said, can you take me? I want to see her house. I think she'd be a great character for a novel. I'd like to see her house. And this is a big strapping guy. And he said, I'm not going anywhere near her. And he said, if you see her, don't look in her eyes. And she said, I'll take you to the bottom of the hill and drop you off, but you're going to walk the rest of the way. I didn't have the courage to do it because everybody was scared of her. So, but I mean, she comes off and, you know, you think, oh, this is a caricature. But, and then on a later visit, I actually laid eyes on her. She exists. She was in prison the first time I was there. Yeah, for burning down a boyfriend's house, and then she was out the next time I was there. So I did
really
get to see her, but that's what I'm
did
saying.
Did you look in her eyes?
No, I was about 300 yards away in a boat, and the guy who was driving the boat wouldn't look in her eyes. 300 yards away, I swear.
It's hilarious. You know, this Buck Nance.
Yes.
The guy that I think of, obviously, he's drawn from the Duck Dynasty.
Yeah.
Thing.
Yeah, possibly. Yeah.
I mean, he is absurd. The scenario, no.
They're out there.
Not really.
The shows are absurd. This America's fascination with redneck culture is absurd, and that's what you have to understand. But Buck Nance in the novel is a guy who's in the star of this new reality show called Bayou Brethren, and it's him and his brothers supposedly on a high end chicken farm down in the Louisiana Bayou. Well, they're not Louisiana rednecks. They were in a bad accordion band in Wisconsin. And they had the beard going, and they won an audition sort of, and they had to have coaching. They had to have redneck training to teach them, you know, how to run the ATVs and the shotguns and stuff that we all do in the South. And they had a Cajun dialect coach, but he starts believing his own press clippings and acting out this some of the intolerance. You know, they build him a fake church on this, and he's a fake deacon, and he gets to make fake sermons about patriotism and America and immigration, and he gets himself in trouble because he goes down to Key West to promote his show, and he's had bad intelligence that Key West is a good place to be telling these sorts of jokes. It's not. So, but anyway, listen, it's not that far-fetched, because if I'd written all that, the book manuscript had been turned in this, you know, and this summer, in July, I turn on the Republican National Convention in Cleveland, Ohio, in the year 2016, and one of the kickoff speakers is a dude from Duck Dynasty.
That's true.
A guy who plays a redneck, who's now a multimillionaire, but he's just an ordinary guy getting up to talk to the Republican Party about ordinary values. I mean, and I was pissed because I never dreamed of having my character address the Republican National Convention.
What have you got against Wisconsin?
Oh, I like
this. Why'd they have to be from Wisconsin?
I was looking for Middle America, and there's a good... I don't want to get into all their backstory, but they had their mother was kind of a liberal Humphrey Democrat. Their dad was a George Wallace kind of guy. And so they grew up with mixed signals, and we all do. But I wanted to like Middle America, and I consider that Middle America. I love Wisconsin. I mean... But I wanted someplace far away from the culture that they were supposed to be, because that's, I'm going to shock you by saying this, some reality TV shows aren't really true. Don't get upset, but this is not out of the realm of possibility in Hollywood. They'll do anything to cash in on a franchise. So that's all that was. You know, I apologize in advance if you read it, but... like I said, it's one of these examples where you're trying to write satire and stay ahead of the curve, and then there's the GOP National Convention, and you think, shh.
You really have an ear for low-life lingo.
Thank you. Thank you.
That's, I mean, yeah. Where'd that come from?
Part of it, I think, is just as years as a reporter, you listen to how people really speak, and they don't speak in perfect sentences, and run-on paragraphs, and when you sit down and talk to a cop to ask him what happened with the crime, he doesn't talk for three pages and explain how he got the evidence.
No, it's the low-life lingo.
Well, I'm getting to that.
Oh, okay.
But I remember one time I was interviewing a biker guy. He was a biker gang in Florida. He was with the Outlaws motorcycle gang, and he was in prison, and his nickname, this is a sort of a giveaway, was Stitch. And he was doing time for murder, or I think it was he got him on a manslaughter. It was a bar fight or something. And I was trying to do a piece on the whole gang culture, and it didn't go very far. But I remember he agreed to talk to me, and I went and sat down with him. And it was just, you know, he didn't have a lot to say to journalists. Stitch didn't. But I said, well, how did this all happen? I mean, what happened in the bar? And he goes, oh, it's my fault. He said something like, his tattoo was bigger than mine. And he just left it at that. That's it. That's all you need to know. Okay.
And a novel was born.
Yeah, but no. I mean, you remember when you're especially a young journalist, you remember these because you're going in expecting that he's going to tell you his whole life story. Not really. His tattoo was bigger. You know, he was kind of an a-hole, you know. And that's it. End of story. And you think that's what you do with your imagination, though, is you file this stuff away. And when you come up with a character, you remember, what did he sound like? How did he speak? What did he look like when he was saying this stuff? And it lodges in your head, and it does resurface.
It's the really compelling rhythm of it. It's almost like you don't go too far. You know where to, you know, pull it back.
Well, I think more is less. And I mean, I was a big fan and also a friend of Elmore Leonard. And he was just an incredibly cool dude, by the way. But also, he believed if you can say it in fewer words, say it in fewer words, especially with dialogue. And a lot, and I think it's important. I agonize over the dialogue. I mean, I every passage that you see, is however simple it might look on the page to you, I mean, I agonized over what you said. The rhythm of it is so important, and the economy of it, and who's saying it, and would they say that, and would they use that adjective? It's one of these things you wake up in the middle of the night, literally, and say, but wait a minute, that thing I wrote today, he wouldn't say it that way, he'd say this instead. You know, I mean, it just haunts you because it has to be pitch perfect because people have to believe it. And
right.
One of Leonard's things that he always said and was that if people are noticing the writing, then you're not doing it right. If it's authentic and accurate and if it flows and it's moving, then you're doing it right. But if they hang up on a word, or if they hang up on a sentence for some reason, something's wrong.
Even if it's to admire it?
Well, I mean, I think maybe at the end of the chapter you say that was pretty good and you go back. But I mean, I think when I'm reading, I mean, as a writer, I stop all the time. But I also stop when I'm aggravated if I'm reading something. Why did they use that? Why did they do that? But I think most people who are on an airplane or reading or something, they just want to be swept along. And part of it is the pace that you want to keep going. But yeah, I mean, I don't write to have people stop and say that was a great sentence. But in my head, if I've written a pretty good sentence, I think I know it. I'm not laughing when I write it. I think I know at some point, something in my brain says, that's funny, just the way it is. Stop right there. Don't write another line of dialogue there. I think, you know, you just get an instinct for it. But I'm not, I look like, when I walk out of my office, I look like I just wrote a funeral notice. I mean, I don't look like, oh, that was hilarious. I mean, that isn't how the process works. You just beat yourself up.
You know, the thing about Elmore Leonard's writing, I always felt like he was detached, that there was a coolness to it. I feel like you're close and there's heat to it. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense because he was all about the storytelling, and I'm all about purging demons. I mean, obviously, obviously I'm not well if you read this stuff. I mean, I don't think it's any big secret, but you know, I've got stuff that bothers me, you know, and I think I am pissed off about a lot of things. So when I write a character like Buck Nance, who's like a fake redneck, but he's still stirring sort of this cauldron of hate and bigotry a little bit, and I mean, those are things that piss me off in real life. So something not good is going to happen to him in my books. Something unpleasant is going to happen to him, and I'm going to feel really great writing that scene. And that's just pure selfishness. I'm going to tell you, it's not literary, but it's me getting it out of my system. And now, given what's this political season that we're going through. You know, I mean, it's come to the fore even more. I mean, I think it was even, you know, if I had to write that character again, I'd probably be tougher on poor Buck than I was.
You would.
Yeah.
I was reading something that Leonard told the New York Times about good guys and villains. He said, the bad guys are the fun guys.
Yeah.
The only people I have trouble with are the so-called normal types. Their language isn't very colorful, and they don't talk with any certain sound. Which, I mean, there's a lot of ambivalence with your characters. They're not all good or all bad,
right.
Are they?
I mean, that's the trick, I think, is that, and this is a lesson you learn the hard way in journalism, is that even the people that you think are heroic or the good guys or whatever can end up disappointing you. And so you, there is an ambivalence. And you also know that even, for instance, even old Stitch sitting in that jail cell, there was a code that he lived by. And I don't want to be trite about it, but you could be talking to a murderer, a bad dude, a real awful guy, and then he mentions the kitten that he had when he was 7 years old, and there's a tear in his eye, and you're thinking, so there is some sort of shred of humanity there. And if you're going to write real-life characters in a real-life way, you have to acknowledge all those facets of the personality. So there's a trick to it. And I think also, I mean, I'm not sure I agree with what he said. I think that the good guys or the ordinary, I don't think there's anybody who's ordinary. I don't think... and I think if you can listen to anybody long enough, it's going to get interesting. And that's because, I mean, as a journalist, you're covering, bond hearings for a sewage project, and you're sitting there with your notebook. I mean, you got to make that interesting. So this is nothing from what you know what I'm saying.
Does Buck Nance have any redemptive qualities to him?
I won't give away the ending of the book, but I think he comes face to face in this book, in Razor Girl, with one of his own creations. Basically, someone that worships the show and digs his rants about Muslims and Catholics and African Americans and all this stuff, and who really believes it. He's not acting. This is a guy, he's just a fifth-rate burglar who has become fixated with this TV show. And Buck Nance comes face to face with him for a long period of time, and I think he starts to realize that, holy crap, this guy might not have been like this before he started watching my show, and now he worships me. And there's a realization moment. I'm not saying he's a great hero, but I'm saying that it's an awakening.
Did you finish this before the presidential campaign, or?
Yeah, I did. I finished it. I turned it in before it got into full swing. I mean,
okay.
Trump had already declared his candidacy, but it was before it really got rocking and rolling. Yeah, I turned in the manuscript. Yeah, and then just watched in disbelief, as I am now in disbelief that we've come this far. And this is, again, I mean, this is Tom Wolfe couldn't have written what's been. I mean, this is Bonfire of the Vanities times 10. It's been interesting, but again, I think that any writer who tells you that this isn't some sort of, I think you have to be personal for it to be really, really good. I mean, and so there's stuff in there that I put in there just because I wanted to. It maybe had no literary value at all, but I just said, you know what? I want to do this to that guy. It made me feel better.
I need this.
Yeah, I need this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you all for coming out tonight.
You've been listening to Cary Miller's Talking Volume series, a session held last week at the Fitzgerald Theater. Carl Hiaasen spoke about his novel Razor Girl. Tomorrow at this hour, an Intelligence Squared debate about climate change.